Drive with Julian Clover.
Getting you home.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
My guest today is one of the UK's leading professors of politics. David Runciman is Professor of Politics at Cambridge University and also head of the Department of Politics and International Studies. His new book is How Democracy Ends. Good afternoon, David. Thanks for coming in.
Pleasure.
This is one of these things where we can't really deal with it in 10 minutes. But when did the end of democracy start, if indeed it has?
So part of the point of the book is to say that there's a lot of talk at the moment about democracy being in real trouble. A lot of it stems from Trump, frankly. I think when he won, a lot of people started to think that something's gone badly wrong. And then the fear gets ratcheted up. This is fascism coming back. We're going to go back to the 1930s. This thing's going to fall apart. So my argument is actually we're worrying about the wrong thing, that we're not at risk of that kind of failure. Democracy is not going to just snap.
So Trump is no different to when, I don't know, Reagan was elected.
He's a bit
and
different.
Somebody, yeah, but that's possibly understatement.
Certainly I remember when Reagan was elected, there was a lot of
almost half the same gags are kind of coming back.
Yeah. And movie star, TV star.
Yeah, absolutely.
Doesn't know what he's doing. Too stupid for this office. I mean, Trump is a bit different. We have to accept that he kind of talks like no president has ever talked, but it is mainly talk, and the talk reminds people. It kind of triggers people. They remember a kind of politics that's absolutely brutal. But I don't think American institutions are going to collapse. So what I say in the book is that 21st century democratic failure is not going to look like the 20th century. We should stop looking back. We should think about the future. This could all go wrong. I mean, nothing lasts forever. Those are the first three words of my book. Some point democracy will come to an end. But it's going to be a new story, and I'm trying to find the new story and not... And I say this as a historian, not dwell in the past.
Do we know what the clues are? Are there some pointers either in, if you like, the direction of travel, not necessarily the leaders who are being elected? It might be something way in the distance.
Yeah, and I think also a lot of it is beneath the surface too. So I think a lot of the big changes we don't notice because they're slow. So we notice the big events. Trump wins, Brexit happens, and they are literally overnight events. I mean, we probably have all been through it for one or other of these at 3 a.m, suddenly thinking, oh my God, has that just happened? And we think this is the end.
Well, the Brexit result is, I guess, the classic one. You go to bed and the...
Yeah, don't go to bed is the lesson.
I have to go to bed. I'm normally here first thing in the morning doing the results. But yeah,
a lot of people I met have had that story of waking up their partner or even their kids and saying, you know that thing I told you yesterday? Not true. I was one of those. Sent my kids to bed saying one thing, turned out something else. So there's that. That's the kind of headline story. But then the deep trends, I mean, some of the things I write about in my book, we're getting much older. Like, these are aging democracies, pensioner democracies. Democracy always used to be about young people. It's now about old people. We're networked in ways we never were before. Just the ways in which we connect. So elections aren't the whole story, because a lot of democratic politics happens in these other routes. We are actually much more peaceful than we used to be. So a lot of the fear of democratic failure is violence. Like, it's going to be a coup. You know, the generals are going to take over. The soldiers are going to take over. They're not. I'm pretty confident about that. So we're looking for those kind of headline breakpoints. And actually, this is, I try and describe it as a kind of 50-year story. Aging, networked, peaceful, prosperous societies like ours. That's what we are. Mm. But we could still mess this up.
Do things like, I wonder, during the week we've had more tales of retail gloom, you know, Marks and Spencer's shutting 100 stores, including one not too far away in Newmarket. You know, they're employing people, and it still takes out sort of a chunk of the workforce, if you
Absolutely.
Like.
Absolutely, and one of the stories we all really do have to think about, but we find it hard to connect to our experience of politics, is automation, what's happening to the labour force. Probably in the next 50 years, what work means is the thing that's going to change most dramatically. So that will change democracy. I mean, democracy is built on a kind of 20th century model of work and employment. It's not going to break it. I mean, if robots start taking our jobs, it's not suddenly going to snap. But how we experience politics will be so different. And the politicians are really struggling to find the language to talk about this. You know, in our last general election, was anyone talking about automation? No, they were talking about Brexit or fox hunting or...
But there always seems to be something of a lag time, doesn't there, between what politicians are talking about. Obviously, there are issues like the NHS, which are, for obvious reasons, omnipresent. But there, you know, you mentioned automation is one. And the rise of the internet as a communication means.
And again, what we want is the thing that suddenly makes it real. And in some ways, we then overreact. So fake news and this fear that somehow the internet has poisoned democracy because no one can believe anything anymore.
And I'm wondering if maybe Trump's got it right in terms of using, we all, laugh and sneer at the fact he's up at goodness knows what hour, using Twitter. But it is, as he sees it, no doubt, a very effective means of communicating.
Yeah, and that's why
people.
I think with Trump, it's a mistake to see him as a throwback. Is he Hitler? Is he Mussolini? No, he's the classic 21st century politician. He got Twitter faster than anyone else. And he actually is the person who knows how to use this. And one of the things he spotted is we're living in a world where attention is the most precious commodity. The thing that you need is to get people to notice you. Trump is now probably the most famous human being who has ever lived in name recognition terms. He's probably just moved ahead of Jesus Christ, which is a terrifying thought. But he spotted that. He spotted that this politics is now partly in a world where people can flick and switch and click and change, holding their attention. So he holds people's attention better than any politician in my lifetime. And that's a skill.
And politicians here, it's interesting the way they seem to use social media. And I mean politicians rather than their agents or the people in the back office who write something on their behalf. It does seem to skew towards the left. And I don't know if that's what we hear about an ageing Conservative Party or if simply those people within the Labour movement have simply got Twitter slightly better than those on the right.
Yeah, I think it is one of these things that does depend, because in the States you see it was the Trump movement that somehow got it here in the last election. It was the people around Corbyn, I don't think Corbyn himself, but it was that part of the Labour movement that got it. And one of the things is there's often this sort of conversation that's happening about politics that you don't hear if you're not part of it. And even in the last general election, people were astonished by the result. Labour did much, much better than anyone thought, because the BBC wasn't picking up on it, the mainstream news wasn't picking up on it. It was happening on Facebook. And if you weren't in those groups, you didn't hear it, but those were massive groups. I mean, massive groups. Some of the most shared stories about Theresa May and the ivory trade never appeared in the mainstream media. And then you discover afterwards that millions and millions of people thought that was the news.
It's interesting because sometimes, particularly on a Saturday afternoon, there will be something which does the rounds on Twitter and it says, there's thousands of people on the streets of London. They're past Broadcasting House, but the BBC aren't reporting it. And you look and you do a quick hunt and you realise that they are reporting it, but the perception gets out there that they're not. Mm. And nobody ever moans that about Sky News simply because they're too far out in Austerlitz. So, does that create in itself a problem for democracy where people it's not necessarily this sort of tunnel view kind of thing, but it's just a different prism of what is or may be happening. Because as you say, it could be a perfectly legitimate story, which for whatever reason doesn't get picked up on.
Yeah, I think it is. So the part of it is that a lot of things are going on that we don't hear about. And then there's also that feeling that people have that what they are experiencing is not being heard and felt anywhere else because there are so many different little networks and communities. Mm. And so there's that real frustration now. Why are we having to hear about the other people? Why are we not getting our fair share? And there's no question our politics is angrier. There's no question our politics has got more frustration.
And what's caused that? It's almost like the opposite of you saying there's less violence than there used to be.
So it isn't. I mean, I don't think that we're angry because we're so much worse off, we're so much more insecure. I think in some ways we're angry because we think we can get away with it. So the conclusion I drew after Trump was elected was not that people had given up on democracy, but they had so much faith in it, they thought it could survive Trump. It's like, we actually believe in these institutions, so we're going to elect this guy just to kind of shake them up a bit. And there is that feeling that I don't think people's rage is they want to rip democracy down and replace it with fascism or communism. I think they're frustrated with it and they're shaking it, but they actually think it can survive. I even think Brexit is part of that. That part of the reason people voted for Brexit is they have confidence in our institutions that will see us through Brexit. I mean, you wouldn't do it if you thought democracy couldn't cope.
But it does seem to polarise, just yet another thing that polarises society as a whole, really.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that Brexit did reveal is that we're divided in ways we didn't realise. So, and you see this in university town. It's one of the things that's really risen up the agenda. You see it in Cambridge, but actually most university towns had this experience. They voted Remain, and the areas around them voted Leave. And we didn't really know that. I mean, I'm not just speaking for myself. I think a lot of people got a snapshot of a country they hadn't quite realised they lived in, where whether or not you went to university was the single biggest divider in the Brexit vote. And for most of my life studying politics, that was not really an issue. It was a bit of an issue. But the idea that that's what divides us, this is new. These are new challenges. Generation gap, whether you're 60 or whether you're 30, that's a bigger gap than how much you earn.
And the issue that Cambridge is pretty much a Labour city these days, certainly based on the last general election, arguably the local election results of a few weeks ago as well. Mm. And as we know, we voted to remain. However, you can go to a very strong Labour city in the northeast of Britain, and there's probably quite a few to choose from, and you got completely the opposite result.
And, yeah, and the Labour Party's obviously got a huge challenge here, and politics is more volatile, no question. So this now feels like a safe Labour seat, huge majority. It went from being a really tight marginal in a couple of years to being a safe Labour seat. It's probably not that safe, because Brexit could upend this all again. I mean, the Labour Party is treading a fine line by not saying what it thinks, but in a really strong Remain town like this, if Labour actually is forced the other way, all bets could be off again.
And this is a dangerous last question, because it could open up so many other different avenues. But do we see more political parties, not necessarily to the extent of, I don't know, the couple of dozen that you might have in the Netherlands, but perhaps a split Conservative Party into two, or a split Labour Party into two, maybe even along Brexit lines?
Yeah, I mean, that is the huge question. I think the barrier of the first-past-the-post system is a huge one. And the last election, after all, actually reduced the number of parties in the sense that UKIP was almost wiped out. Labour and the Tories got 80%+ of the vote between them.
But both Labour and Conservative seem to be both, government and opposition in one.
They do. And you feel that something's got to give, and it's almost this chicken and egg thing. The voting system has to change for the parties to change, but the parties have to change for the voting system to change. But what we have learnt on these nights where we go to bed thinking one thing and wake up the next morning discovering something else is true is that you shouldn't think in democracy at the moment that just because it's the way we've always done it, it's going to stay like that. It could change pretty fast.
Oh, that's dangerous, isn't it, going to bed? I rethink my plans.
Dangerous going to bed.
I don't, but on
election night, my advice is stay up.
Yeah, but when you're doing... I think we might need to talk about this closer to the election, David. Thank you.
I'll come back.
Please do. Thank you for coming in. The book, How Democracy Ends, by David Runciman, my guest this evening, is published by Profile. I've got the price here. It kind of varies these days, doesn't it?
But well, I guess tell me what it costs.
Well, here it says £14.99.
It's probably cheaper in one or two hours. Very good value.
Rest my case. David Runciman, thanks very much. It's 6:15.